Missouri Governor Eric Greitens warned legislators that they may be brought back for summer school. As it turned out, lawmakers are coming back this week for spring school for a special session of the legislature. Representative Nick Schroer will be one of many lawmakers deciding whether to give a lower rate to some businesses that want to locate in the boot heel. The O'Fallon Republican joins us next on another edition of Politically Speaking. So let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, a candid conversation with the Show Me State's biggest political newsmakers.
I'm Jason Rosenbaum.
And I'm Joe Manis.
That's Eric Greitens, Navy SEALs running for governor, and I'm really, really glad to be on with you, Jason and Joe.
I'm going to push back on these regulators.
I'm doing this for the people.
I was encouraged along the way, not just by my family, but by a lot of teachers and professors, and knew when I was in college that I would run for office someday.
We're very excited about the prospect of having some more free market solutions.
Even though after the conversation, I still might not agree.
We want our listeners to get a real sense of what drives these people.
They're actually people with a story to tell.
And welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in St. Louis Public Radio's beautiful Grand Center studios are
colleague Joe Manis.
And our special guest joining us on the podcast for the very first time. He shaved his incredibly long beard and he looks very presentable.
You mean trimmed?
He trimmed it.
And I'm a little disappointed because you kind of looked like James Harden on the floor a little bit. You know who James Harden is?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
By the way, our guest today is
State Representative Nick Schroer, District 107 in St. Charles County.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Despite the fact that I've insulted the fact that you've trimmed your beard. Before we get to your background and the news of the day, and there is plenty of news that has broken in the last hour, just tell the listeners what your district encompasses.
So my district, it literally runs right through the middle of Highway 70 from out in 6440 and Highway 70 intersect all the way down to Mid Rivers Mall Drive. So I've got a lot of St. Peter's, most of O'Fallon, half of Lake St. Louis, and then a little bit of Wentzville.
You're one of the many St. Charles County legislators, a delegation that has grown over the last 10 or 20 years because the population of St. Charles County has exploded, essentially.
Yes, yeah, and the St. Charles area has more votes now than the city of St. Louis.
I'm sure that's a very proud recognition.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I think when we redistrict it in a couple of years, I think we're going to possibly pick up another senator, maybe another one or two state rep seats,
yeah,
because out of the entire state of Missouri, St. Charles County is booming. When other counties, other cities are losing population, we're gaining.
Yeah, not to get too in the weeds, but you were actually very close to a third senator in 2011. I think you missed it by maybe a few thousand people. So it's inevitable that I think you're going to get to three.
Correct.
Yeah, and what's key about this is that if they gain one, somebody else loses one.
Absolutely.
So that's the whole, I mean, it's like a game of musical chairs.
Musical chairs. So tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of your professional background, and why you decided to enter the crazy world of Missouri politics.
A crazy world indeed. So I grew up in Ferguson, Missouri, which I never thought that anybody out in Europe would know, but when I vacation now and people want to know where I'm from, just mentioning Ferguson, Missouri, everybody knows where that is on a map.
Absolutely.
I also have a farm out in Fayette, Missouri, so I think that as far as the legislature is concerned, those two entities, Ferguson, Missouri, the rural aspect of it in Fayette, Missouri, that helps me with a lot of legislation. Don Roan had legislation with certain agricultural things, and where other people are tuning out, I'm right there zoned in.
Yeah, explain for our listeners where Fayette, Missouri is and where your farm is, because that's going to play into what we talk about in a couple minutes.
So it's not where Don Roan's district is. So Fayette, Missouri is in the heart of Missouri. It's out in Howard County, just past the last exit past Mizzou. And a little known fact about this exit, there was a TV show called Midway USA.
Oh yeah, so, I've been to that truck stop. You know, continue.
It was a fun show, but so I grew up in those two areas. First member of my family to go to college on a football scholarship. Ended up getting an acting when I found out that I was injured. Graduated from University of Missouri St. Louis with a criminal justice degree. Wanted to be an undercover federal agent. Growing up in Ferguson, Missouri, I found a lot of my friends, even relatives that I had, were hit by drug use and things of that nature, and their scholarships were cut out, and their education was cut short. So that was the game plan until I met my beautiful wife, and she said, "You were not doing that to our family, going undercover." So that's when I went to law school. was in an apolitical family growing up, wanted nothing to do with politics. One side were, you know, big Reaganites, the other side, big Clinton family.
I was going to say, like, Ferguson, Missouri is pretty Democratic, and Howard County, where Fayette is, has been traditionally one of the most Democratic rural counties in the state of Missouri.
Absolutely.
It has now gone more Republican in the last few years, but from your background, it wouldn't seem likely that you would have become a Republican.
So where'd you end up getting your law school degree?
Well, I ended up going to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale.
Okay, so when'd you graduate?
2013.
Oh, okay. Okay. Both of my kids are lawyers. That's why I asked.
That has to be a disclosure, but continue.
So after I went into law school, had, like I said, no interest in politics. I saw what it could do. You never talk politics, you never talk religion, and those are two things that I harp on all the time now. So in my con law class, I think it was my 1L year, there was an issue that came up, and it was the right to life issue, Roe v. Wade, and I'm very passionate about that and started debating somebody on the other side of that issue, which led me into being elected president of the Law School Republicans and the Federalist Society out at SIU. Disclosure, my brother-in-law is Robert Cornejo, and during that time, he was elected, you know, doing things out here in the state of Missouri, and I saw how hectic the legislature can be on your family. And now he has three children. At the time, I didn't have any, but I knew I wanted a family, and came back to the state of Missouri, and I figured that politics was not in it for me. Well, being an attorney, being a conservative attorney, I had a lot of people pushing me to run, and when Ron Hicks, the predecessor of mine, decided not to run again, I saw that as a door opening. I threw my name in, and I won pretty handedly, but I was sick of the federal overreach. I was sick of a lot of the political correctness in not only the state of Missouri, but the United States. And I think speaking for my district in the way that I have, I think they're pretty proud.
Yeah, just so our listeners know, Cornejo is also
an attorney.
Yes, also an attorney and also in the House.
And as I was explaining for the show, before the show, he has been on our podcast at least two times, and he was always a great guest. And so far, you're off to a great start. Other than shaving the beard. So before we get into your reflections on the session, we do want to look forward a little bit, because right before we pressed record on the show, Governor Eric Greitens announced that there will be a special session starting on Monday, when this show will likely be posted.
Yeah, so likely while you're listening to this, the legislators are already in Jeff City working on their special session, and it's supposed to deal with one issue, which is it's to allow the Public Service Commission to negotiate lower utility rates for two proposed projects in Southeast Missouri. One of them would reopen the smelter plant known as, I mean, it's got a new name, but frankly, most people know it as Noranda, which for a long time was the largest non-agricultural job provider in Southeast Missouri. Aluminum smelter closed last year, in part because of the crashing of aluminum prices nationally. And then there's also a proposal to put a steel plant in that part of the state. So the legislators there really want those jobs, and there's other states that are lobbying for the steel plant. That's the background.
That's the backdrop. And before we get your take on this, this is not exactly a surprise, because this is Governor Eric Greitens basically saying that there was going to be a special session sooner rather than later.
If you say, what's the grade that I'd give the legislature, you know, frankly, sometimes it looked like third grade. You know, sometimes you had career politicians who, instead of actually fighting for the people of Missouri and fighting for jobs, they were singing Kumbaya. Instead of actually fighting for our law enforcement officers and having their back, they were out there reading Shakespeare. Those are exactly the kind of games that people are sick of. So what kind of grade would I give to the legislature? The grade's incomplete. You know, we've done some really, really good work, our administration has. But the legislature, their work's certainly incomplete. And you know what? Sometimes when you don't complete all of your work, you need to go to summer school.
Well, it turns out that you're coming back for spring school, because summer doesn't start until June. What's your reaction to the fact that you will be coming back for a special session? And there was a very passionate speech by Representative Don Roan on this issue. When this is going to be the main focus of the special session, what is kind of going to be your thought process?
Originally, looking at the different aspects of the possibility of a special session. Number one, being a fiscal conservative, the cost. And that was something that I told my colleagues, I told my constituents, if it's a situation where we're coming back just to play tiddlywinks again to get nothing done at the, you know, 16, I forget what it was, like 100 and something thousand dollars, taxpayer dollars for the per diem. Then in that situation, it's unneeded. However, looking into this situation, I call it an Aranda deal too. You can see that this could bring over 500 jobs to the area. However, I balance that with what's it going to do to my district? What's it going to do to the people, other people in other parts of the state that aren't being represented by that, to their rates? However, I think when you weigh the cost-benefit analysis like I do, I'm general counsel for a couple businesses, and when we make those business decisions, applying that way of thinking to this situation, I think if it does bring 500 jobs and it does not negatively impact other rates, other rate increases across the state, I think the benefit could outweigh the cost, possibly.
Well, one of the arguments, I'd written a lot of stories about this issue about 3 years ago when Narand at that point was still operating, but they were trying to get they had gotten a lower special rate for ages, but they were trying still doing some negotiations with Ameren on some stuff. Well, the argument was that, if they, or let's say the steel plant, too, get lower rates, then that means other electrical consumers could get, I mean, Ameren's arguing that they're going to get higher rates, and that there also may be a push by other major manufacturers and businesses that consume a lot of energy. Let's say Boeing, I'm just throwing a name out, might also say, well, hey, if they're getting if they're paying a lower rate, why aren't we? So I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Does this open sort of a Pandora's box for the state?
Being the green freshman as I am, I think it could. And I try to play devil's advocate all the time and figure out what's best for the state. I don't like the state. I don't like any government picking winners and losers. So I want to make sure before I push the red or green button on Monday or whenever we deal with this, that it is going to be the right thing for not only that part of the state of Missouri, but for all Missourians. And the rate hikes, the possibility of a rate hike, that's something that is extremely concerning to me, because I'm technically from two parts of this state, two totally different parts of this state. But as far as the special session is concerned, I've got a lot of friends in the legislature who've been there for a long time. And they've complained to me about, you know, staying down there for 5 months, away from their families, getting a lot of work done, getting a lot of bills passed. Once they reach the governor's desk, they're vetoed. So I'm happy that we have the possibility of a governor that's going to work with us and sign some good legislation. I know we signed the Uber bill, which is huge, Uber Lyft, for our district, and it's already very impactful right now. So the possibility of going for just this this cutout, the Don Roan bill alone, it possibly could have a huge impact fiscally to our state.
Yeah, I mean, just so our listeners know, chances are, well, the governor has to detail what the topics are. You can't just go to special session and start being a free-for-all, as sometimes the regular session is. So if it's just on this bill, it's just on that bill. But that means it could be done in a day.
It could, but I think it might take a little bit longer than that because it has to go to the committee process. It has to be voted on in the House. It has to be voted on in the Senate. And given that the opposition to this was in the Senate, primarily for the reasons that you mentioned in the devil's advocate point, that it could raise rates for everybody else, I'm not really sure that it's going to just fly through the Senate very smoothly. And that's what Don Roan's entire speech was about.
Well, when we saw on the floor the speech, the very, very passionate speech,
yes.
So much so that Representative Roan got so worked up, his nose started bleeding at the very end.
Yes, it did.
But this is a situation where I think the House, he's lobbied for his district alone. On this issue alone, I still have some questions. I think some other legislators have questions, but you saw it was an almost unanimous vote to put this amendment back on a different bill.
And before we go into more general topics, somebody told me on the floor that the reason why it was so quiet in the House, and it's not usually very quiet in the House when people are speaking, is apparently, because I'm not in the legislature all the time, Representative Roan doesn't speak on the floor very often. And then when he got up to make such an impassioned speech, it's an example of what happens when you kind of save your best ammo for the right moment.
Absolutely. Being an attorney, being a litigator, when I was in the courtroom all the time in family law cases, I would do the same thing. You know, you wait to use your bullets for certain things that you want to make very impactful. And I think the nickname that they call him, the Don, it's because when he does talk, everybody listens. He's one of the most well-respected legislators up there.
So let's talk a little bit about your impressions of your first legislative session, beyond just the general impressions of your first legislative session. I know that there were a lot of bills that you tried to pass. Some, I think, were more successful than others. Give me kind of an insider's view on what it was like to deal with this session for you.
I think comparing it to other sessions, this is my first one, hopefully the first of many. And I think this session, it was a very conservative session. We see a comparison to other ones where hundreds of bills were passed. Again, how many made it past the governor's desk? But I think the fact that I'm being sent down here is not just to pass legislation, it's to kill the bad things too, to effectively advocate and speak for my district. And I think I did that this year. But it was kind of frustrating at times because you have certain individuals that want to kill your bill for whatever reason or won't move your bill for a certain reason. And I think a lot of the bills that I passed got some great coverage, got some great committee hearings and stuff like that, to where I think when I file these things next year, I'm going to be on a better footing to see what I have to do. And it's totally different than the courtroom. It's totally different than the business world. But it's very similar because you have to work with both sides of the aisle to actually get things done that are going to help the state of Missouri.
Now, are there particular bills that you either didn't get through or that you, for whatever reason, that you plan to make a big focus when the General Assembly goes back into regular session in
Absolutely.
January? Can you talk about those, at least the topics?
One of them kind of hits home to me. Growing up in Ferguson, Missouri, I had a lot of friends who did get in trouble with the law. And I saw whether they were 14, 15, 16, 17, or even there's still some people that were neighbors of mine that are still in prison. And I've got a bill, 274, that was filed this year, would have raised the age of criminal prosecution on juveniles from right now they're automatically being charged as adults at 17 years old, despite the fact that throughout this state they can't buy cigarettes, they can't enter into contracts without parental consent. If something happens to their families, they're treated as juveniles. And this is a bill that would state that even between 12 and 17, they could still be certified as an adult, depending on the circumstances. The prosecutor, the judge, they could have a hearing to figure out if that person needs to be an adult juvenile or criminal justice system. And the Department of Corrections came out after the fiscal note was blundered several different times, which has happened in the 44 other states that this thing has passed through. So 44 other states have had this. They've seen exponential savings, and that's what the Department of Corrections says, is we can save $14 million a year in taxpayer dollars each year by just passing this.
So, I mean, so the idea is that for what, nonviolent offenses or just
for most offenses?
Okay, for most offenses, the prosecutor and the judge could decide not to charge them as an adult?
Correct.
Okay.
So, and it's not like they're getting off scot-free, because right. I used to represent people in the juvenile justice system. And what it does, and another aspect of this that a lot of people loved, is the fact that when somebody's charged as an adult at 17, parents are not really informed. They have no say in sitting there while the child's being interrogated. To what this would do is restore those parental rights and preserve those parental rights. And just like you said, for most cases, whether you're 12, 17 years old, if it's your first offense, if it's something minor like stealing a pack of M&Ms from Schnucks, you shouldn't be charged as an adult, because that's going to, number one, and this has been shown in 44 other states, it's going to be on your record. You won't be able to apply to different colleges and get federal funding and grants and things like that. You won't be able to get scholarships. You can't get into the military. You can't get a job. So what do? After you've been housed in the adult jail system, you learn the ways, and the recidivism rates for individuals like that are exponentially higher than those who are in these 44 other states that are first housed in the juvenile justice system or sent back home on house arrest.
So, and I just want to touch on a point that Joe made. If like a 15-year-old commits a murder or a rape, they could still potentially be charged as an adult.
Absolutely. Even a 12-year-old, too.
Yeah. Yeah, because I would imagine that there have been situations before where juveniles commit really heinous crimes that may rise to the point where they need to be charged as an adult. Now, when you're talking about a situation where it's stealing or robbery, I could see that not being the case.
Or drug use.
Or drug use or drug dealing, something along that lines. So how far did this get in the process? Because I know that there was some advocacy for this. I saw a lot of social media activity about it. Obviously it didn't pass, but how did it kind of fare this year?
A little bit of a background is this thing, unknown to me before I filed it, it's been filed many different times, many different sessions by many different legislators. But this is the first year that it's actually not only made it out of the House, it got voted out of committee back up out of committee 9-1, but it also made it out of the House. I got it on several Senate bills when they came over, had unanimous voice support. It got voice voted unanimously, got put onto several bills, but with the Hammerschmidt and stuff like that, the senators decided to take it off. But the senators, they started listening to the arguments on this bill, and they said that they would support it if it comes up next year.
Mm-hmm. So maybe just as a standalone bill or in a broader criminal, you know,
correct
code bill or something like that. So that'd be something we'll be watching next year for sure. So I want to ask a little bit more generally, and I'm going to use this sound clip to be the jumping off point. I talked to a lot of legislators when I was in Jefferson City last week, Democrats, Republicans, people from all over the state. And there was kind of a mixed consensus about how the governor handled the legislature. Some, like many Republicans in the House, felt it was refreshing to have a governor be kind of on hand to talk about legislation. Other people thought he was too heavy-handed. Democrats, you know, were probably going to criticize the governor anyway. So this is a supercut of Representative Nate Walker, Republican from Kirksville, Senator Scott Sifton, a Democrat from Afton, and Senate President Pro Tem Ron Richard, a Republican from Joplin.
It's pretty audacious to be taking unlimited dark money, not telling anybody who's paying for the ads, and then complaining about people not passing ethics reform. That's pretty gutsy.
There's lots of big egos in the General Assembly, and sometimes trying to persuade them with tactics that might be used in warfare are not necessarily successful.
You can't get personalities in the middle of policy. You just don't take it personal. And I give the governor a chance because he's new, but I would encourage him not to do that anymore.
That's Scott Sifton, Nate Walker, and Ron Richard. I wanted to make sure that I got the order correctly.
Yeah, and Richard is referring to what Sifton was talking about, which was about these ads that a nonprofit that the governor and his allies set up, which takes unlimited amounts from unlimited donors, they ran some attack ads against some members of the state Senate.
So with that as a backdrop, I'd like to hear your observations about how you felt the governor did this session.
Again, as a brand new freshman, I can't really compare it firsthand. I can only compare it to what I've heard. And when I turn and I would see the governor on the side of the floor, or I'd see him walk in the halls, talking to different legislators, asking about our families, I thought that was a little bit refreshing. I thought that was good to see a leader kind of getting down with the troops and figuring out what we're going through on a day-to-day basis. I also think, as I said before, I think it's very good to see a governor working with the legislators in a way that we know when we pass a bill, let's say Uber Lyft bill, that we know it's going to get signed. Rather than waiting, 5 months out of the year, working our tails off, getting things to the governor, and then they are vetoed. So from that point, I was very happy at seeing our leadership working together with House representatives, the Senate. Looking back, you see that ethics was the first thing that we took up. It was something that our speaker, who I'm very proud of, Todd Richardson, said that we were going to deal with on day one. And being on General Laws Committee, the first day of session, I was hearing these bills at 7 a.m. in the morning. So a lot of coffee on that day. But I'm proud that the House kicked it out. I don't know what was going on with the Senate, why they couldn't get to it, take it up, and pass it.
Well, that's actually a great segue to our next audio clip. It is of State Representative Justin Alferman, the sponsor of a lobbyist gift restriction bill. I don't call it a gift ban because it doesn't completely ban lobbyist gifts, but it pretty much curtails it pretty significantly. And what has been said by many senators, including on the Republican side, is that a new Missouri kind of hurt efforts to pass a lobbyist gift ban in the Senate. What I would say in the governor's defense is that a lobbyist gift ban has always faced a lot of opposition in the Senate, even before Governor Greitens came along.
Correct.
And this is what Representative Alferman had to say on that point.
I think both issues need to be addressed. I think that, you know, looking at 501c3, c4 entities and their political involvement and making sure those are being disclosed, and ethics reform in the term of lobbyist gifts, both absolutely need to be addressed. And I think you can do both, and I think they can be separate from each other.
So what is kind of your feeling on that? Because from talking with a lot of Republican members of the House, they kind of echo Representative Alferman's sentiments that many senators that opposed the lobbyist gift ban using the 501c4 issue as pretext were using that as a crutch because they may not want to give up lobbyist gifts.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I think, too, especially when we pass I would say the biggest ethical reform that the House has put out in, I think, forever. And then seeing the Senate not really do anything. It kind of takes me back to when I was in the primary, and we had a guy who I was running against, good guy, but then you look at the city council of O'Fallon, and I state this because this is on the news recently, the cash for trash deal. I don't know if anybody saw that out in the city of O'Fallon where money was coming in, kind of influenced certain votes on something that hurt the people of O'Fallon. And that's one of the things that I want to speak up for. I think Governor Greitens campaigned on it. I campaigned on it. A lot of people campaigned on it, is bringing the voice back to the people. Rather than special interests, rather than lobbyists, we need people advocating for their districts. And that's why I support ethical reform. I want Representative Alferman to file this again. I've heard it in committee. I've heard it on the floor. And I will fight to get this thing passed.
And, you know, what is kind of your feeling on the 501c4 issue? Because I have heard a lot of conservatives say, you know, I don't think it's right to try and disclose donors to a nonprofit. That's sort of the argument that Greg Keller and Carl Bearden and some Republican senators like Senator Bill Eigel have put forward. Mm-hmm. I've also heard the other argument that if you're going to get involved in the political process in a monetary way, people should know who's funding that. I'd like to hear your perspective on that, because that might be an issue that comes up next year.
So not really having a background to give me the information that I needed, I did turn to a lot of those guys that you mentioned on both sides of this argument to figure out, you know, what is the deal behind these 501c4s and what's the big hubbub about it? So I think the First Amendment and like Carl Bearden and all these other Senator Eigel alluded to is the protection of somebody who I would say doesn't really know they're getting politically oriented. If somebody wants to donate to Planned Parenthood just because they support whatever they do, or if they want to donate to the NRA because they support whatever they do, doesn't really correlate and equal at them. They're giving money to, you know, Representative Nick Schroer or Senator Bill Eigel. And that's where I kind of draw the line is, you know, do we really want to disclose all these people who are supporting a certain cause, not really knowing where that money's going to go?
Well, it depends on whether or not. I mean, I'm not advocating one way or the other, but like Planned Parenthood, the NRA, for example, they have to set up political arms. And so people give the money to those political arms. And those are, I mean, disclosed. Now, 501c4s, which some on both parties use. I mean, just for example, Progress Missouri, which is probably the largest active progressive group in the state, that's a 501c4.
Right.
So they don't identify their donors. People suspect it's unions and teacher groups, but they don't know. And in some states, including New York, they make a distinction. If the 501c4 is involved in political campaigns, any political involvement they get, they do have to disclose their donors. In other words, like Greitens Group, which is a New Missouri, would have had to disclose their donors because they were running these ads against some senators.
So I do want to talk about some of the bills that happened in the last week of session. One of them that I think was the most controversial was Senate Bill 43. That's kind of the nickname we're giving as a shorthand to a bill that changes employment discrimination law pretty dramatically. Now, I'm not sure if that's an area of law that you deal with quite a bit, but as an attorney, I'm pretty sure that you were asked about it a lot. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, because the governor is getting requests to veto that, mainly from Democrats, but also some Republicans like Representative Jay Barnes, and I believe Shamed Dogan of Baldwin is also opposed to it. What's kind of your thought on that?
Well, I stood up on the floor and I said this. I think I'm the only legislator that's been on both sides of this issue. I've represented people in employment discrimination cases, and I've represented businesses now in employment discrimination cases. And I will state that I have many friends on the first side, representing people in discrimination cases, that say when these situations come up, because of the contributing factor language, it's almost like money in the bank just right away. As long as you're in a protected class, you don't have to be fired for that reason, because the microcosm of the facts that you just have to prove, And a lot of attorneys, I've seen this happen in courtrooms where they take a piece of paper and they take a tiny, tiny section of it and they float it in the air. Just that tiny little section, they say, if we can just prove that little portion, then you have to rule for us. So on the other side now, having cases where businesses in my district, and that's kind of the way I got my job now, is having these small business meet and greets and talking to different business owners about the issues, about regulations, the strangulation of the federal government, the state government. Now representing a small business and having a lot of friends that are small business owners, they've come to me and they said, look, when we get, whether it's a letter, a threatening lawsuit, or a lawsuit in and of itself, 99% of the time they end up in a settlement. Why? Why can't you fight that? Because you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars in claims, whether it's a frivolous case or not. And even if the judge rules that plaintiff, whether it was a frivolous case or not, has to pay a portion of the attorney fees, that likely never happens, even at, you know, whether they're judgment proof or not. So in the past 10 years, you've seen this situation where the law, the way that it was, the way that the intent of the law was set up, we've gotten so watered down and we've gotten so away from the true intent of the law that we needed to change it. And that was something where I was a big advocate of changing the contributing factor to the motivating factor, which a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, not to mention names, but there were a lot of people that said, if that was a standalone bill, I'd support that all day long. Mm-hmm. Then you get into the weeds of the individual liability. And this is something where I had to stand up on the floor again and explain to everybody, you sue, let's just say, ABC Company.
Right.
They are headquartered in California. However, they've got a branch out here in Missouri, and you want to get them into the Missouri courts because whether you believe it or not, the whole quote-unquote judicial hellhole issues and the venue shopping that happens here, you want to get them in the state of Missouri, so then you tag Joe Blow into the case, and he works for ABC Company. Well, that's going to keep it in the state court, and you can get it into the Missouri courts. That's what they were trying to prevent, and I asked a lot of these small business owners, how often does that happen to you? They said more so than not. Now, what happens at the end of the case is that they will either A, settle with the big company, because that's where the money is, that's where the big pockets are, and you release that person, you settle, and they're not held liable whatsoever, or you try the case, and they will dismiss the claim against that individual at the very last minute because they know where the big pockets are. However, this bill, it could be law soon, it does not prevent anything from happening. If, let's say, I assault you and then you sue the company because I was under the umbrella, I was under the scope of the employment there, you could still file a police report and the police could have a criminal cause after me, separate and aside from the civil action.
So, I did something on this just a couple days ago. I was talking to lawyers and others on both sides, and one of the arguments was particularly the whistleblower aspect, saying there's 33 court cases that involve Department of Corrections employees who are claiming various forms of harassment, either from sexual assault all the way to somebody saying making racial epithets at them, and that they say that could be affected by this suit, and that there's other cases of state whistleblowers, especially on the managerial level, on the second tier, they're not that could be affected by this, and they think it's really going to put a chill, if not make it very difficult, for whistleblowers to have any sort of protections in Missouri. I'm just wondering your thoughts on this, since you voted for the bill and you looked at this and you're a lawyer. I'm interested in your take on this.
That was another thing that I dug up in my research prior to the bill hitting the floor, and that was something where we thought it was going to hit the floor on a Monday, then it didn't, and then a couple weeks later go by. So I had plenty of time to research this, and my interpretation of this, my understanding is that this bill, Senate Bill 43, would actually codify the whistleblower and anti-retaliation prongs of common law, which would still protect people who are a whistleblower. You can't retaliate against them because of that. I understand that there were some concern. There were some statements on the floor about that. There were some statements on the floor about the Senate sponsor of this having a lawsuit against him right now, yes. And they're not going to support it because they think that that's going to affect that law. There's nothing that's retroactive in this bill whatsoever.
Right, correct.
And, there were a lot of fires that we had to put out because there were some people that were very confused on the floor. Just like, you know, if we talk about a pharmacist bill, I'm very confused. So when somebody talks about a legal bill and having the legal terminology and things like that, if people aren't using layman's terms, it can be very confusing.
Now, the other bill that I think caused a lot of controversy near the middle of the last day was this legislation sponsored by a fellow freshman, Mark Matheson, I think is his name.
Matheson.
Matheson. I apologize for pronouncing his
name. He's probably got the best radio voice of anybody I've ever heard. No offense.
No, I think we're probably, because you said that, I think we're going to have him on the show soon. And basically, this was a bill that would have bought out some homes close to the Westlake landfill. Am I correct on that, Joe?
Yes. Well, basically, because actually, this was an offshoot of State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal's bill in the Senate that would have set up the first stages of a fund. I want to make that clear. There wasn't enough money that was going to be allocated to buy them, but it would have affected up to about 90 homes that are around the, quote, Westlake / Bridgeton landfills. These are two landfills that are connected. One of them is governed by the state, which is the Bridgeton landfill. The other is overseen by the federal government, which is the Westlake landfill. Westlake has radioactive waste in it. The Bridgeton landfill has an underground fire. And there's concern that those two are going to collide.
All right, with that backdrop, the reason I'm mentioning this, although this is, I don't want to say it's not close to your district, but it is kind of more of a North St. Louis County issue. When that bill ended up failing, it affected the rest of the session. Like, the Senate went into complete chaos. They only were able to pass the minimum wage nullification bill because Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal filibustered it. And I don't have the vote count in front of me, but I do remember being told that a lot of people, including Democrats, didn't end up voting on that bill. Am I correct on that, Joe?
Yeah, it was between 63 and 65 votes that it got. So it was short, almost 20 votes of what it needed to pass.
I don't know how you voted on it, but the collapse of that bill did have a huge impact on the rest of the session. What do you think happened there, and why do you think it ended up failing? Because I have my theories, but you were there voting on it.
Well, why did it have such a dramatic impact?
Yeah, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know that earlier in the session, I thought I read somewhere that the Senate sponsor, who I like a lot, a lot of people that aren't in the legislature can't really understand that the Republicans and Democrats can get along. Mm. I've got great friends on both sides of the aisle. I like her a lot, but I don't like the fact that she reportedly stated that if this thing doesn't pass, I'm going to hold it up and I'm going to kill a lot of bills by filibustering. And I think when
Which is what she did.
And you played that clip of Governor Greitens stating sometimes we act like third graders. Sometimes we did. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we saw a lot of the people get elected that were quote unquote political outsiders, whether in the federal government, state government. I was one that had never ran before, and I think that's something a lot of people are getting fed up with, is that one person, whether they're in the House or Senate, can just hold up everything and kill these very, very important bills. And now you see us going back for a special session. Don't know if that's relative to what happened on the last day of session or not.
So the last topic I want to talk about before we wrap up is the bill that passed near the end of session, which was this bill getting rid of local minimum wage increases. Now, the chances of that ever occurring in any place in St. Charles, I think, is basically zero. It's a very Republican area of the state, even on a local level. And I don't think County Executive Ellman or any of the mayors have any interest in raising the minimum wage locally. But obviously, that's happened in St. Louis City. It was about to be considered in Kansas City. And I want to just know, why do you think the legislature needed to get involved in that? Because if Republicans think it's such bad policy, why don't they just let the bad policy hurt St. Louis and not just kind of swoop in and save them from themselves?
It's interesting that you said that, because when this bill originally came up, there was another Republican representative from St. Charles County asking me, he inquired of me, saying, well, let's just let this go through, and then we can benefit from the businesses fleeing St. Louis City coming to us. I'm not a fan at all of the government, whether it's federal, state, telling businesses what they can and can't do and forcing a business to, you know, say, hey, you've got to pay X amount. I'm against that. But I am for, you know, you talk about local control. I do want the municipalities to be able to dictate what they can and can't do. However, when you look at the studies that have been done on minimum wage increases, the quote unquote 5 for 15, and what that's done to actual states, the economies of those states, there's a huge fear of what's happening in St. Louis as close as it is to another state. It's not like it's happening in Columbia where these businesses can just branch off into nearby cities. This could branch off into another state in Illinois. Mm-hmm. God forbid, I don't know who would want to go, you know, to Illinois with the fiscal ruin that they're in right now.
Illinois values are a very alluring thing, but continue.
Let's not go there.
However, you know, when you look at the impact that it could have on many families, and we've had business owners calling certain legislators, we're in STL Today, we're published all over the place, talking about the impact that could have not only on summer jobs and their inability to hire summer workers, but the impact that it could have on many families when they have to let these people go. And you're in the heart of St. Louis City, a crime-ridden city right now that we have to try to get a control on the crime. And that's one thing that me, Representative Bruce Franks, and a couple other people from both sides of the aisle approached Speaker Todd Richardson. We want to find a committee where we can have a situation occur where business owners are coming in, law enforcement's coming in, and just residents are coming in telling us not necessarily the legislature can do to fix crime, but what can be done in the city of St. Louis, the city of Kansas City, to fight crime.
That's a great segue to my final announcement that you may have seen on Twitter, but I want to just announce on the show. We will be doing a live edition of Politically Speaking at Yockey's on Cherokee Street on May 31st at 7 p.m. with Representative Bruce Franks of St. Louis. This is the first time that we've ever gone to another location to do the show. I've already talked with Senator Bill Eigel about doing a show in St. Charles in the next, I don't know, couple of months or so. Do you have any recommendations of a good bar where we're in St. Charles?
Maybe we should go off the air about that.
Yeah, I'm not a big bar fly, but there are a lot of small businesses. You guys could even come to Arrowhead Building Supply where I'm general counsel of.
That's not a bad idea.
We may end up doing that. I just wanted to make that clear that we are going to do a Democrat and a Republican live show. And if they're wildly successful, we'll just start doing this more often. But be on the lookout for that, and we'll be reminding people when we have a show next time. In the meantime, thank you so much for coming and talking about the past legislative session and the incoming one. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JMANNIES.
How would people follow you on Twitter or any other part of cyberspace?
On Twitter, I'm at Nick B. Schroer, NickBSchroer. And I forget what my Facebook handle is. Just find me at State Representative Nick Schroer.
Until next time, so long.